welcome to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Search for Captain Slocum, by Walter Magnus Teller. We're on the 8th chapter, and this is the 6th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner to help support the podcast, or you can check out the Mariner podcast with all things sailing and seamanship each week, or of course, the Mariner YouTube channel, where you can see gear reviews, how-to videos, and me engaged in expeditions and projects all over the world. Now on with the story. Chapter 8. Resolved on a Voyage Around the World. Nobody knows just when or how Slocum got the idea of sailing around the world alone, but from the beginning, perhaps unawares, he had been preparing for it. All the experience he had met with in life had conspired to dare him to do it. At the same time, his interests had been narrowing till by 1894 all that was left him was the urge to sail and the urge to excel and be recognised. There was something he wanted to escape to. There was something he wanted to escape from. The only solace lay in action. The captain wrote simply, "I had resolved on a voyage around the world." But one knows that a voyage is never that simple. A man's activities have their obscurer aspects. They do not always arise from conscious sources. It seems likely that the shape and spirit of the spray must have helped shape the idea. She was blunt and beamy, and had plenty of room on deck. Her bows were bluff and full. Her long, clean lines suggested the lines of a barge. The one graceful touch was her cutwater. Forward was a small forecastle with a couple of bunks. Aft was a larger cabin under a low house. Slocum's berth was in the cabin. He could cook, eat, read, sew, and sleep there. He could cook on deck as well. The wheel was only a step or two abaft the companionway. The bulwarks were low, but a stout, hard pine rail, with stanchions, provided a lot for hands and afforded support in the seaway. The freeboard, typical of a Delaware oysterman, was low, but the spray, as Slocum sailed her, was a dry sailor. The spray was comfortable. She was a home. A visitor wrote of the cabin, lined with books, the cosy and livable atmosphere, not like a yacht at all, but more like that of the master of an old-fashioned, fully rigged ship. The rig of the spray at that time was the ordinary one of a sloop with mainsail and jib. A short topmast was carried for signalling. She was a very big boat for one man to handle. Garfield wrote that when he and his father hoisted the mainsail, he would take the peak halyards while the captain took the throat halyards. It was a job for two people. The mainsail and gaff were heavy. I know it was hard for him to raise it when he was alone. The sheets were, of course, belayed aft. Since Slocum's time, several replicas of the spray have been built by admiring yachtsmen. The present writer was aboard one. It had a few improvements which Slocum managed without: a diesel engine, generator, electric lights, 11 cubic foot refrigerator, hot and cold running water and shower, gas for cooking, a thermostatically controlled heating plant for cool weather, ship-to-shore phone, radio, radio direction finder, automatic pilot, and a paid hand to run her. The quality of sailing has changed. In 1895, the changes had barely begun. Of labour-saving appliances on the spray, there were none. There were no time-saving devices either. The captain had time enough. It was really quite simple, for the age of inexorable convenience had not yet arrived. Slocum relied only on himself, on the boat he had made, and on the buoyancy of his hand who made all the worlds. Slocum had circled the globe 5 times, but preparations for a voyage alone were something to think about. It had never been done. There was no pattern to follow. When he began getting ready in earnest, his first thought was of books. From his Aunt Naomi's, he wrote Eugene Hardy, the general manager of Roberts Brothers, "If you could let me have the books you so kindly spoke of the other day, it would be a great help to me, I am sure, for I shall have some time to read." The books came, and on the 9th of January, 1895, Slocum, sounding more like a professor of literature than a deep-water sailor, acknowledged them. "Dear Mr. Hardy, the handsome package of books from Messrs. Roberts Brothers for the Spray Library is greatly appreciated. I will be very glad to take the Libertads, 50, on the terms mentioned. I am completely fascinated with the new books, with Mr. Stevenson's, of course, but above all with this new book, Life and Adventures of John Goldwyn Jebb, by his widow. In this case, at least, I think the widow's mite, a sovereign coin to all of us. I think that Thackeray Goldsmith or even Washington Irving might have written this charming book. It carries me back to Vanity Fair, Vicar of Wakefield, to Astoria, and even to Granada. Quien sabe, there was no time to bury the dead in those days. Mr. Jebb will be along with me on the voyage. 1,000 thanks. Signed, Joshua Slocum. Robert Brothers' very latest publication, A Strange Career, The Life and Adventures of J.G. Jebb by his widow, with an introduction by H. Rider Haggard, meant something to Slocum. Rarely, if ever, in this 19th century, Haggard wrote of Jebb, has a man lived so strange and varied an existence. From the time that he came to manhood, he was a wanderer, and how it chanced that he survived the many perils of his daily life is nothing less than a mystery. In the end, however, they brought his fate upon him prematurely. Slocum was enchanted by the wife's account of the adventurous, athletic, sanguine, and gullible husband. John Beveridge Gladwin Jebb, the soldier, recalled Rawdon Crawley. His endless misfortunes seemed like the Vicar of Wakefield's. Jebb, in the northwest, reminded Slocum of Irving's history of Astor and the fur trade. Jebb, seeking lost mines and fighting Mexicans, was reminiscent of the struggles of the Moors. It is not hard to see why this history of riches to rags aroused in Slocum, at that particular moment, more fellow feeling than literary acuteness. A more scientific and objective mind might have seen in Jebb's story simply a case of extreme hypomania. Mr. Stevenson's book, or books, was probably a reference to R.L.S., for at least one Stevenson made the great voyage with Slocum. Robert's brothers had several on their list: An Inland Voyage, The Silverado Squatters, Travels with a Donkey in the Cevennes, and Treasure Island. The Sprays Library also included Darwin's The Descent of Man and The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals, Newcomb's Popular Astronomy, Todd's Total Eclipses of the Sun, Bates's The Naturalist on the Amazons, Macaulay's History of England, Trevelyan's Life of Macaulay, Boswell's Johnson, a set of Shakespeare, Don Quixote, Life of the Mississippi, and in the Poet's Corner, the works of Lamb, Moore, Burns, Tennyson, and Longfellow. Still more books were to come from an old acquaintance, Adam W. Wagnalls, encyclopedist and founder of the firm of Funk and Wagnalls. Next, the captain made preparations to write. With the help of Eugene Hardy, he got up what he called a syndicate to publish the travel letters he planned to produce. He does not, however, seem to have had firm commitments. The Louisville Courier-Journal, for example, would not contract for the series. They wrote they would like to submit the letters, we to pay for what is used. The Boston Globe was one of the syndicate, so was the New York Sun and other newspapers. At last the captain had the properly commercial and unromantic reply to the vexing question, will it pay? And to the lubberly one, what is the object of the voyage? It is mainly to make money, Slocum said. I shall send accounts of my trip to a syndicate of papers, and I think I shall have something interesting to tell. He developed another wrinkle. Though in size the Spray was a 1/30 of the little bark, the Aquidneck, the ex-merchantman felt once more ready for trade. I shan't carry much cargo, he said, but the Spray will be pretty well filled with curios of various kinds before she gets back. For the rest, grocers and other tradesmen in Boston stocked him with supplies, for the one thing Slocum lacked was money. He put revolvers and rifles on board. He took only the simplest of medicines and some disinfectants. In the cabin were charts for all over the world, a sextant, a compass, and chronometer, and the latest Massey patent taffrail log for measuring speed and distance. Getting ready to go, Slocum was cheerful. He spoke nonchalantly to reporters who came down to the dock on the East Boston side of the harbour where the Spray was moored. After a talk with the captain and an examination of his boat, something of his own confidence communicates itself to the inquirer, and the adventure does not seem so strange or so impossible of successful issue as many less promising ones which have had a happy termination. Behind the anonymous newspaper accounts were all sorts of newspaper men, sympathetic, facetious, or slipshod, or writers of deathless prose. A reporter asked the captain how he would handle the boat. "Well, she is very easily managed, even in a breeze," Slocum replied. "And then, too, I have a steering gear which will act automatically when the boat is once laid on her course, and that will give me some chance to rest." "What about sleep?" Slocum answered that he was used to going without sleep for 2 or 3 days at a time. Actually, he had not only unusual muscular strength, but exceptional powers of resisting fatigue. 30 hours at the wheel in a storm, he found, did not overtax his human endurance. But his plan in ordinary weather was to sleep in the daytime and keep the boat going at night. "When it blows too hard, I shall get out my sea anchor, batten everything down tight, and go below for a sleep, and let the gale blow itself out." To another reporter, Slocum said, "I don't go out like the dumb and blind. Understanding nautical astronomy, I will, of course, navigate the world around with some degree of precision natural to any first-rate navigator. But there is one thing new in my outfit, already tested, the workings of which you will hear of in my letters. It will be of great value at sea. Without it, I could hardly dare to go on a voyage alone." The captain said he reckoned it would be his last voyage. He said he hoped to make enough out of it to return home to his wife and 4 children, buy a little farm, and settle down. Action is the friend of beguiling illusion, and now that Slocum stood on the verge of departure, he could dream of wife and home. This is the dream of the wanderer and the homeless. The captain's home was not with Hetty, who may have loved him once but scarcely understood him. She was no Virginia, with flashing eyes and brilliant intuitions, the game companion on deck, the reading companion in the cabin. Hetty was doomed to disappoint and to be disappointed. She was financially disappointed, certainly. She had no roof she could call her own. On the one hand, there was the still young, and by now bewildered, dressmaker. On the other, the sea-drawn escapologist at a critical stage of life. She could not have been important to him, though he tried to consider her. Their incompatibility was deeply distressing, but it had its uses. It helped the captain preserve his independence for the peculiar purposes of his life. Slocum told reporters he would sail alone, unless my wife changes her mind about staying ashore. But he must have known very well that she was not going. He had asked her, and she had replied, "Joshua, I've had a voyage." She was thinking of the hardships of the trip in the Libertad 6 years before, while the captain remembered the satisfactions that the small boat voyage had brought. Those days on the water had been happy days for him. Now it seemed that the only way to be carefree again was to go on another such voyage. Captain Slocum, the ex-merchantman and little-known author, was ready to put to sea. He described the route he proposed to follow. It bears little resemblance to the one he took. He said that he thought the voyage would last 2 years, thus underestimating the time by more than 50%. Then, almost at the very last minute, he was visited by a lady of literary tastes. She was Mabel Wagnalls, the unmarried 24-year-old daughter of Adam Wagnalls. Mabel was not an upcountry girl. She had been raised with books and music and money. She spoke in a cultivated voice. Her air of high culture was fascinating to Slocum. She respected learning, and she wanted to write. The enterprise that the old knight of action was about to embark on touched her imagination and heart. She took the captain a copy of her own first book, Mizrahi, a musical story. On her visiting card, which she pasted inside the volume, she wrote, "Wishing you a safe and successful return." It was a very conventional phrase, yet understanding and affection can live in such simple words. Captain Slocum had failed in the eyes of the world, and in Hetty's eyes, but not in Mabel's. The young lady said to the grizzled seafarer, "The spray will come back." And there was, after all, balm in Gilead, and it was to this near stranger that he turned, in dreaming, during the lonely years ahead. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next installment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.